so I decided to apply.
Yeah.
Also, it looked to me one of those situations possibly where the sooner you did it, the better. It turned out in practice that that wasn't quite correct, because they came a little later on, people became harder to get, and they made better, more generous offers.
Ah, yeah.
People that joined in 1947 and 48 got more generous terms than those who joined right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. However, no complaints on that score.
Nevertheless, you had a reasonable rank by that time.
Yeah,
so you
And so, after leaving HMCS Haida, and we had just spent our time as part of a three-destroyer squadron off Halifax, based on Halifax, and most of it on anti-submarine training. We usually rendezvoused with a U.S. naval submarine somewhere and for a week or two at a time, and did exercises, and then came home and went out and did it again. My daughter, first child, was born in 1947, and she was christened in the ship's bell in HMCS Haida. And that was a rather nerve-wracking experience, because the day she was to be christened, we were sent out to sea on some torpedo fire exercises, and we lost a torpedo. And the rules of the game were, those days, were you stay at sea till you found the thing. We didn't, in fact, stay at sea till we found it, but we were awfully late getting back. And my wife and the screaming child were on the jetty, waiting when we arrived alongside. One other interesting but sad experience was that HMCS Nootka, it was, who... no, sorry, Micmac. HMCS Micmac was also being brought into service to serve in the squadron. And one day she was out doing full power trials, and she became enclosed with the merchant ship called the Yarmouth County. And there were a number of people killed. And our ship was the one that was sent out to bring her in. And I personally became a sort of an engineering consultant to the lawyer, civilian lawyer, who handled the case for the Navy in the lawsuit that went on between the Yarmouth County owners and the government.
Was it mechanical fault?
It was purely a question of fog.
Yeah.
Micmac was doing full power trials, and she steamed into a fog bank. And it hardly got her nose into it when she hit this ship. She had radar, but it hadn't picked up the ship, and so on. It was just one of those freak fog bank things.
Yeah.
And my role was to advise on what amount of damage was resulting from what degree of speed, that sort of thing. You know, kinetic energy and all this. Calculations, and I never appeared in court. All I did was write letters to the lawyer, and he seemed to take these off to court and argue them successfully. It didn't cost the government too much, I don't think.
Tell me, how did you enjoy getting back into a much more sophisticated engine ship than the frigates? I mean, you must have been happy, in a sense, to get into that, or were you?
Yes, I was quite happy. It was more sophisticated. The crew, contrary to what you might think, were not all pre-war RCN. Some of them were. The captain was. Lieutenant Commander Caldwell, now Commodore Caldwell. But most of the other officers were VRs who had transferred, like myself, and quite a few of the men were also VRs. But we did have quite a few chief petty officers and so on who had been pre-war RCN. So it was a rather mixture of the old pre-war Navy and wartime entries, and a few post-war entries.
Presumably, from an engineering point of view, Haida didn't have any of the same problems that the Canadian-built tribals did with their turbines and so on. There was quite a bit of a problem there due to
the gearing.
general inexperience in manufacturing those sort of things in Canada, but being British built, I guess there was no problem with that at all.
No, didn't have that sort of problem, but we did have other problems of lack of interchangeability of parts with the Canadian tribals and just lack of parts. British are never noted for being very good manufacturers of spare gear or having a high degree of interchangeability.
What about the amenities, the ventilation system, refrigeration system? Were your cold rooms up to snuff?
No, they were no better than the frigates sort of thing. It was the same sort of thing,
yeah.
Really. Maybe perhaps the refrigeration room was a little bit better, but we had no air conditioning of any kind. So as far as the living accommodation is concerned, it was hammocks and there were no bunks and so
you
on.
You had steam heat by that time, I presume, did you?
We had steam heat, yes.
Yeah.
Well, so we did in the Canadian ships, too, yeah.
Oh, yes. British ships very often, though, didn't have any.
Yeah.
That's why.
No, we had steam heat and it worked pretty well, although I didn't have too much need to use it. Yeah, I mean, I was never there in the dead of winter, really.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
I joined the ship towards spring.
Can you say anything about the problems of the gearing in the Canadian built tribals? Were you familiar with what they had there? See, I don't really know a great deal about it. I know the problems did exist. And,
Yes, well, my memory is very hazy about it, and I didn't really have anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Although later on, I had those jobs where I would have had everything to do with it, you know, because I ended up.
Yeah.
By being in charge of ship construction and design and everything else. But as far as those tribals are concerned, I didn't have anything to do with them. But I do remember that what some of the problems were that gearing has to be very accurately machined. And unless you keep the gear cutting machines going 24 hours a day, you can get a slight change in temperature between the time you shut the gear cutting machine down one day and you start it up the next. And that could lead to ridges or daily bands, as they called them, on gear teeth, which had to be honed out by hand and so on. And there was some of that sort of problem in these things.
Oh, I see, yeah.
But also, I believe there was a problem with the steel, the quality of steel, and so on, that didn't wear quite as well as the steel that was made in England, or hadn't been hardened to quite the right degree. But to be fair, I'm really any knowledge I had of that was hearsay, and it's a long time back, so I shouldn't get involved.
Well, it was
my close contact with new construction and building machinery in Canada started in 1952.
Oh, yeah. With the new class of destroyer escorts, right?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I see.
And I'll come to that later,
yeah.
But...
Yeah, okay, well, we'll go back to where you were training. Hello, you. Oh, look at you.
Hello, Thatches.
Yeah, I shouldn't be talking like that on here, should I? Well, that interruption is down for posterity, I guess.
Yeah.
But
Yes, well, I left Hyder, went to the dockyard, and I served two very, I think, rather happy years in Halifax Dockyard. And my job there was to be in charge of all ship modifications, alterations and additions, we called them, or A's and A's. But any time a ship had to be modernized or modified or updated, there was a series of these alterations that you had on the list, and I was responsible for sort of putting these together on paper and then arranging for them to be carried out.
So you became more involved then in ship construction or marine engineering as distinct from engine room engineering.
Yes, yes, that marked the transition.
Yeah.
And
did you go on course or anything for this one?
No. I I worked under Commodore Porteous, he was by this time. Now, he was the superintendent of the dockyard, and I was on his staff. And
Were there people who had actually, who had trained as naval constructors, as shipbuilding engineers, in the Canadian Navy at that time? Distinct from your
no,
own kind of training?
No. The people who design warships are called naval constructors, at least in the Royal Navy and the Canadian Navy. And we didn't have any in the Canadian Navy at all, really. We did recruit a few during the war and did train them and so on, but we were borrowing them from the Royal Navy as late as, the 60s, I guess. But we did form a constructor branch just after the war, but there weren't very many people in it.
Well, you can tell by my questions. I have never interviewed an engineer commodore before.
Well,
that's why you ask me these questions.
Anyway, I did 2 years, and we did such things as fitting out a frigate to make it into a weather ship, HMCS St. Stephen.
Stonetown, isn't it?
Yes.
Went the same way, isn't it?
Stonetown became a weather ship on the West Coast, but I didn't have anything to do with that.
That's where I heard of it.
Yeah. But the HMCS St. Stephen became the weather ship on the East Coast, and I was responsible for all the design changes and so on that were necessary to do that. We even rigged a sail on the ship to sort of help her steady her course when she was just on station and just trying to keep her head into the wind.
What sort of the staff did you have in your particular office at that time?
I had a staff of about 8 or 10 draftsmen, and a head clerk, and a stenographer. You know, a staff of about 12 altogether.
Yeah. Were you the only engineer in the place?
I was the only officer, the only engineer, yes. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't the only engineering effort that went into it.
Oh, no.
There were other engineering departments. There was an electrical engineering department, there was a construction department, and there was a mechanical engineering department, and so on, in the yard. And I drew on their expertise, but I was the coordinator really of the design.
Yeah.
And by this time, we still had big ships, 2 cruisers and an aircraft carrier, and the steps up the ladder meant that having been the engineer officer of a small ship, you should then, your next step was to be the second engineer of a big ship. And, but just to confuse the layman, the second engineer in a big ship is called the senior engineer. And the...
As distinct from the chief, eh?
Yes, and the chief engineer is called the engineer officer.
Yeah.
But the term senior engineer goes back in history, and it goes back to the days when the engineer officer was not really an engineer, but and he had a civilian engineer who was, and the civilian engineer was called a senior engineer.
Oh, I see.
And the engineer officer was somebody who was just told to look after the engineering department. So this tradition went down through history. And I was about the 1st of June 1950, posted to HMCS Ontario on the West Coast. To be the senior engineer.
I guess Jay Calder was here about that time, wasn't he?
Yes, he was in the ship for part of that time, too.
Yeah.
And I served in HMCS Ontario for 2 years, almost to the day, from June 1950 to July 1951, 52, rather. And I was promoted to commander on the half-yearly promotion list, which came out on the 1st of July, 1952, and sent once more to Ottawa. I don't know whether we need to go into the HMCS Ontario thing very much, but it was a most interesting experience. Spent most of the time at sea. My wife and family, by this time we had 2 children, were with me in Victoria. Never saw very much of them. We did a long cruise to Australia, New Zealand, Fiji, Honolulu, and so on in the spring of 1951. And we did another cruise up around the Queen Charlotte Islands, northern areas of B.C., taking up to Governor, much the same as trip as he's just done more recently.
Would you like to say a word about how the engine room was organized? I mean, apart from the three watches, or how many an engine room and boiler in a ship that size?
Yes, well, we had two engine rooms and two boiler rooms in that ship, and four shafts for, the two inner shafts were from the after engine room, and the two outer shafts were from the forward engine room. The two shafts from the forward engine room actually passed through the after engine room, or two compartments alongside the after engine room. And then two boiler rooms, each with two boilers forward of that again. So we had four boilers and four sets of main engines. And that was a big ship, 80,000 horsepower. And a big crew, I wouldn't like to specify the number we had in the engine room, but it was the vicinity of 100, I guess. And there was a commander, as chief engineer, lieutenant commander, myself, senior engineer, and we had about eight other engineers, watchkeepers and specialists and some under training and so on.
At this stage, presumably you didn't stand watch.
No, I didn't, I didn't stand any watches then. But I had to sort of be responsible for everything. And the senior engineer was really the working head of the engine department. He really did everything and reported it correct or otherwise to the commander.
Somewhat like an executive officer.
Yeah, The engineer officer had the responsibility, but the actual work was almost totally delegated to he only had one person reporting to him, really, and that was the senior engineer. And it worked all right. I had no problems. We had one or two interesting episodes. One occasion we had a complete blackout at sea, just about on the equator. We had a man who got injured in an accident, and we were rushing him to hospital in Fiji. And we'd only had two boilers steaming. We really needed four for full speed, and while they were trying to bring the second two boilers on, they really demanded too much of the other two, and they lost power, lost steam, and everything just died in the ocean. And it took
How would that happen? You're going along it. Well, pouring it on like nobody's business.
Pouring on like nobody's business, and the people on watch, in effect, opened the throttles a bit too wide, and the steam pressure finally just dropped. And instead of, before they got them shut, the thing had dropped, and some of the machinery had tripped. They have governors that trip when the speed gets too low. And one thing led to another, and we had a complete blackout in a very, very hot part of the ocean. And
the captain must have been dancing a little jig by that time, wasn't he, on the bridge?
So, to make a long story short, it took a few hours before we got going again.
Yeah.
And the next most, one that lives in my memory forever, and I guess it should be reported somewhere, is that we had the Queen and her husband on board for 3 days. This was around on the East Coast. We'd been sent around the East Coast just to do this trip, take the Queen and her husband from, Princess she was then, but Andrew Philip, from Quebec City to Sydney, Charlottetown, St. John, Newfoundland, and then they were aboard a passenger ship at Newfoundland and steam home. And between Charlottetown and Sydney, I guess it was, we were steaming along, very nice, bright night. We were doing about 27 knots, and I had resorted to all sorts of special precautions, to make sure that nothing went wrong. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, I was still up, and I was writing a letter home telling what all this was like and what it was all about. And all of a sudden, I heard a gushing sound outside my cabin, and I went and leaned out and stuck my hand out and pulled it in, and it was black, oil fuel. And I quickly, if I had a telephone in my cabin, phoned the engine room, said, for goodness sake, whatever you're pumping, stop it. You know, wherever you're pumping the oil to, stop right away. Well, it turned out that what had happened was that the way you fed the boilers in these ships was from a ready-use tank, and you pumped the oil, transferred the oil from the storage tanks to this ready-use tank, and then the ready-use tank was used to pump into the boilers. And I'd had one experience before where we'd let this ready-use tank get too low, and we'd had a temporary shutdown, you know, an unscheduled shutdown, and I was going to avoid this. And so I wrote in the night order book, keep these tanks at about 80% of capacity, mm-hmm. or something of that nature, which meant they were always pretty close to full. Well, the young man whose job it was to transfer the fuel started up the pumps and went to have a smoke or something, and the next thing you know, they were full and they were overflowing through an overflow pipe which went up to the upper deck and came down just outside my cabin. That's how I happened to...
You mean it was coming down the outside of the ship?
Outside of the ship, yep. On the upper deck. Black oil fuel.
The first lieutenant must have been happy to see that the next morning.
two in the morning.
Yeah.
We had about 30 or 40 newspaper men and photographers on board and so on. And I sure didn't want this story to get out.
Yeah.
So, and we didn't alter speed, we didn't do anything, we just kept going. I got the fuel stopped. I don't know how many hundreds of gallons had come up onto the upper deck in this black stuff. And at 27 knots, it was just carried aft. And my main worry was that the Queen, the Princess, who was sleeping in the captain's cabin on the starboard side of the ship aft, it was a warm night, and I was sure the side scuttle would be open, and I was afraid some of this oil would be carried right in through the scuttle. But it didn't happen, but it just covered all the superstructure on the side of the ship. Well, we went around, we got quietly as we could, and we aroused all the stokers, and they were called engineering mechanics by this time, and changed the name. And we got them with long-handled brushes and soaked in diesel fuel, and we mopped all this stuff up and had just about all of it done. And we managed to not have the story hit the press, even though we were just loaded with newspaper men. They would just love to have
it. You were lucky,
yeah. Yeah, we were sure lucky, but
yeah.
We worked all night. So I almost went down in history as the engineer officer who poured oil fuel all over the Queen. That's enough of
it. The captain would have been happy to hear him going for that, wouldn't he? Eh? Well, that was very good. And then you carried on in Ontario for how long?
I until 1st July, 1952.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned earlier, I was in the 1st of July 1952 promotion list to commander. Prince Philip was also in the same list, promoted to commander, incidentally.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Oh. That's something, eh? Same seniority. Yeah.
Same seniority, yeah, same day. He got ahead of me after that.
Yes.
And, well, I mention this because they used to put out a combined list on the 1st of January and 1st of July, Royal Navy, Canadian Navy, New Zealand Navy, Australian Navy, the whole lot, you know. We finally broke away from that, but days we were part of their...
Had one advantage anyway, he kept you up abreast of people you knew elsewhere,
yes,
of course.
Yeah.
And,
so we left the Ontario about the first week in July, drove by car across country to Ottawa, and I took up my new job in Ottawa in the summer of, real hot summer of 1952.
What job was that?
Worked in those wretched old temporary buildings in Ottawa. The job, I was assistant engineer in chief, and we had two or three assistant engineer in chiefs up there, but anyway, I was the assistant engineer in chief responsible for machinery design, and that's where I came face to face with the new shipbuilding programs, the Salaron class destroyers, the Restigouche class destroyers, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And for the next 3 years, from 1952 to 1955, I worked on those programs.
Well, I think we better pack it in there.
Sure,
because we're out of tape.
Oh, are we? Yeah.
And Perhaps we could pick up there on our next another session.
I think that's a good idea, and I think there's quite a bit more to cover in the ship design business.
Yeah.
Because
I'm sure there is. Yeah.
Went in and out of that several times. Later on.
That should be. I'd like to get that down on tape. Okay.
I'm W.S. Thackeray. I'm interviewing Commodore A. Graham Bridgman. It's the 4th of July, 1980.
That's fine. Yeah. Okay, here we are, and I wonder if you would like to give me your impressions of what went on with the beginnings of the DDH program.
Right. Well, I got into the DDH 280 program rather early in its days. I actually sat in on the Defense Council meeting where Mr. Hallier first gave the go-ahead to the program, although I wasn't responsible for it. I was there as an observer. But later on at briefings and presentations to the Defense Council, I had to put together the briefing and the facts. Shaky on the figures, but as I recall, it was 1964 when the first estimates were put together, and in those days, the government at least were not prepared to admit that there was inflation, and so we weren't allowed to put in estimates that were based on future year costs. We were to put them in based on what it would cost to do the job if by some miracle it could be built overnight in 1964. In other words, the estimate was in terms of 1964 dollars. And as I recall, the first estimate was somewhere in the vicinity of between 160 and 170 million dollars for four ships. Later on, of course, the costs rose to something of the order, I think, of 230 million. But nowadays, when we're quite accustomed to inflation, we look back at what the rates of inflation were in the years in question. That is from 1964. To about 1973, we'll remember that we'll readily understand that an increase from 160 odd million to 230 or 240 million is not out of line at all.
Not that much, no.
But nevertheless, we had our noses rubbed in it every month and every week and every year from that day onward, when we came back wanting more money, because although the increased costs were legitimate, there still was a reluctance to accept inflation. And if there was inflation, why hadn't we anticipated it? And every time there was a question of more cost, there was a threat to cancel the program or to reduce it in some way. And I think I said possibly earlier that I spent most of my time as the professional head of the shipbuilding branch in defending the programs and trying to keep them alive against all those who wanted to cut them out.
Yes, I think you made the point that by reducing one ship out of four, you wouldn't really save very much.
That's correct. And the other device that was always suggested to us was to stretch out the program. In other words, spread it over more years.
Mm-hmm.
But that only added to the total cost because you got into years which you wouldn't otherwise have been building in, where the costs were even higher than any other. So every time you stretched out the program, you added to the cost of the total program. And you didn't reduce by very much the cash required for the year in question.
No, and I suppose always ran the danger there of new modifications being brought in all the time.
That was the danger, too.
Yeah.
But apart from fighting to keep the program alive, I also was fighting extremely hard to keep it on time. And because any time anyone came along and said, there's a new gadget and we could work it in if we could only delay the program by 3 months or 6 months, and I could immediately see this as leading to extra costs, and so I always resisted it. So in that respect, I guess I was regarded as a pretty difficult person to deal with because I appeared to be against change. But the number of changes you can have in a big ship program in a large shipbuilding program are so great that you just have to draw the line somewhere and say, we'll stop here. So that was the cost aspect. There were technical changes along the way. I remember one major one when a group of weapons and operations officers came to me along with my own staff electronics officers and said, Litton Systems Limited has developed a third generation of computer technology, and we should scrap the command and control system that we were planning and go for this third generation of micro miniaturized circuitry, I think was the word. This horrified me, but I did suggest to them that they go ahead and get estimates and timetables and so on. And to make the story short, we did eventually end up by discarding the plans for the old system and going for the Litton system. I believe the old one would have been a Westinghouse system, but it was fairly large and heavy and cumbersome. So that was a major change. But it worked out well in the end, and we got a good system out of it. I suppose the most traumatic experience of the whole program was the selection of the main machinery. And as I think I mentioned in my earlier discussion, one of the features of this program that was pretty well forced on us was the the competitive bidding and fixed cost, fixed price tenders.
Yeah.
And so every system that there was, we had to prepare specifications for and then go out to tenders and get people to prepare detailed designs, detailed proposals with costs, timetables, etc. And one of the major packages was the main machinery, which was to be an all-gas turbine package, no steam or diesel in it at all. And we ended up with two main competitors, Rolls-Bristol, I guess it was, in England, and United Aircraft in Montreal, which was really Pratt Whitney in the United States. The system would come from Pratt Whitney in the States, but a lot of the parts would be built in Montreal. And so it was really a United States versus a British competition, and there was a lot at stake, not just the dollars for producing the hardware, but the prestige of being the country that provided the machinery for the first all-gas turbine warship in the world. And as the program developed, we got into more and more controversy. But we did get really good cooperation from the bidders. They worked hard and they put together really comprehensive bids and designs. And we then had we got them all in on the deadline, and we had an evaluation process. And in the end, the United States proposal won. It was selected in a point system. They came out on top.
How many points were given to the fact that Pratt and Whitney could produce some of this machinery in Canada?
I'm not going to attempt to describe the points. It was
Okay.
It's several years ago, and it was a very complicated system.
Was this a major factor, though, the fact that it would be producing?
Yes. There were points for Canadian content and so on.
I see.
But basically, the points were for excellency of design.
Yeah.
That was the main thing, coming closest to meeting the requirements. Anything else was of lesser significance. I can't remember precisely who the Prime Minister of Great Britain was at the time, but I think it was Sir Harold Macmillan. Anyway, the lobbying for this contract from both sides, but particularly from the British side, was extremely intense. And the question went all the way up to the Prime Minister, to Prime Minister level. And when we announced that the American proposal had won, we were immediately presented with an appeal to reassess the thing, and we were ordered to do so by Prime Minister Pearson himself. And so the way this went, we had to convene a conference with the technical experts who had done the evaluation, myself in the chair, and the various members of the British consortium there to fire questions at us. And I remember it was a really hot, sticky afternoon, and we were in a conference room that was too small, too crowded, and it was not very pleasant. However, I had received instructions that the moment the meeting was over, I was to personally phone Prime Minister Pearson and tell him the result of the reappraisal. And so we had the session and managed to convince the British team of experts, who really were experts, that there were better features in the other system than they had produced, and they were very gracious and finally accepted the decision as inevitable. And I found that when I did phone the Prime Minister's office, that the British High Commissioner had already beaten me to it, and he had reported to them that they'd had a very good hearing, that they were very satisfied, and the problem was all over.
It was over, yeah.
But it was a really sticky time for a while.
What were the advantages of the American machinery?
As I recall, it was basically in the control system, which was more sophisticated and better thought out. I think it wasn't the strength or ruggedness of the turbines or anything. It was basically the rather sophisticated automatic computer control system. And without going into any great detail,
fine.
I think
that was
really what it was.
Yeah. And in practice, this machinery has worked well.
In practice, it worked, and it's worked well. And while one used to hear a lot of criticism about various shipbuilding programs, I think since the DDH 280 class were completed, I personally have never seen any adverse comment in the press or on the radio or TV or anywhere, although there may have been some, I'm not aware of it. There was criticism, certainly, while the program was underway because of the escalating costs. But I think eventually those were accepted as inevitable and a product of inflation, and that died down. And the cost per ship, which worked out to $60 million or something like that, is very low now compared to what it would cost to build a similar ship. So I think there's no one raking over the coals and complaining anymore about the cost either.
Were these vessels almost entirely Canadian design? You bought the parts.
No, the concept was entirely Canadian design.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The individual components were taken from other sources.
Yeah.
The Sea Sparrow missile came from Raytheon in the States, and it was not too different from a Sea Sparrow missile that was used elsewhere, I guess. Some of the automatic control system for controlling the sonar and that type of thing was a Dutch system from Holland, and the gun was an Italian gun built by the Otto Molara company in Italy. The helicopter was an American helicopter, United Aircraft, but again manufactured in Montreal, mm-hmm. or largely manufactured in Montreal. The variable depth sonar, which was one of the things that you tow behind the ship, was designed and built in Canada. So it was an all-Canadian overall concept, but the components, we shopped for them wherever mm-hmm. we could find them.
I gather you must have had a considerable input from specialists in anti-submarine gunnery and this sort of thing in picking these.
I did indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
There's some very able and very good, well-qualified people in the electronics branches, the weapons branches, and in the operations branch of the... of the Navy, and in the weapons branch too. No, we were not short of quality of experts. We were sometimes short on numbers, but as far as quality was concerned, we had some very highly trained and highly qualified people.
Did it take a long time for these presumably these committees to reach a consensus on a particular weapon? Or they use sort of a point system as you had used for the propulsion machinery?
Yes, there was point systems pretty well throughout, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, it didn't take a long time. In fact, the length of time was getting everybody to submit all the details that you needed in order to apply your point system.
Yeah.
We're forever running into delays in that respect.
Well, it's a very costly business for a firm to produce all this stuff, I suppose, in many...